Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, October 29th, 2018, and I'm your host, Kara Santa Maria. This week, we've got a good one, but before we jump into the interview, I want to thank those of you who have made Talk Nerdy possible. Remember, Talk Nerdy is and will always be 100% free to download, and that's because the show is supported by both ads and also by listeners just like you. If you want to support the show, you can visit patreon.com/talknerdy. That's patreon.com/talknerdy. And you can pledge your support on a per episode basis. Just 50 cents an episode goes a really long way. And I do thank you guys so much for your support. This week, the top supporters are Rob Schreck, Pedro M. Rosario Barbosa, Phil T-Bear, The Zombie Drummer, David J.E. Smith, so sorry, David, Jeffrey Perez, Charles Payet, Jafe, Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, Brian Holden, and Jeffrey Sewell. Guys, I'm so excited to announce that the two books that I've been involved with over the course of the last year are both finally available. You've heard me talk about it before, but The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, How to Know What's Really Real in a World Increasingly Full of Fake. That book was co-written with, of course, the guys from The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, the other podcast that I am a co-host on. That would be by Steve Novella. He actually wrote most of the book, and it was supported by Bob Novella, Jay Novella, Evan Bernstein, and myself, and that's available everywhere books are sold. Also, I am the spokesperson and the quiz master. You'll find out what that means if you crack open the book. For the Almanac 2019, Hot New Science, Incredible Photographs, Maps, Facts, Infographics, and More. And that was published by National Geographic. I'm so thrilled to have been involved in that project. So I hope you guys will check it out. And good news. This is actually really exciting. I think this might be the last chance I have to tell you guys about it. I will be reading clues to promote this book on Jeopardy on November 1st. So check your local listings. Also, SciComm Camp, November 2nd through 4th. It's probably a bit late to apply, but if for whatever reason at the last minute you wanted to come, you may still have a few days to do so. So I thought I would throw that out there. What else? You're already listening to the show, so you don't need me to tell you that you can now download the show at talknerdy.com. Paid a pretty penny for that URL. And also, I have a new URL for the Talk Nerdy store, which is another way you can support the show. Just go to talknerdymerch.com and you can see a bunch of fun t-shirts, winter hats, baseball caps, onesies for the kiddos, all that good stuff. All right, enough about me. How about Hannah? I am really excited about this week's episode because it features Dr. Hannah Fry. She's an associate professor in the mathematics of cities at the Center for Advanced Spatial Analysis at University College London. Hello, that's like the coolest title in the entire world. So she does a lot of really cool stuff working with physicists, computer scientists, architects, geographers. She's looking at the patterns in human behavior in urban settings to try and solve a lot of problems. She also is, you'd probably know her really well, especially if you live in the UK, because she does a lot of on-camera work. She's a public speaker. She talks about how much she loves math, or as they say across the pond, maths. And she's done a bunch of BBC documentaries, City in the Sky, Greatest Inventions, Climate Change by Numbers, a bunch of really, really cool stuff. She's also got a TED Talk. And she is a regular on a long-running UK radio show called The Curious Cases of Rutherford and Fry. She's not a regular. It's her show. She's the Fry. So, guys, check all of that out. But she's here this week to talk about her brand new book. It's called Hello World, Being Human in the Age of Algorithms. So without any further ado, here she is, Dr. Hannah Fry. Well, Hannah, thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Of course. So I am thrilled to talk about all things math, or as you say, maths. And that's because it's mathematics, right?
Well, yeah, but then at the same time, you know, you do say mathematics is rather than mathematics are. So, I mean, even though I naturally say maths, I do sort of think that you guys have got it right.
Oh, you're kind of right. But at the same time, We also say data are and datum is, but nobody actually says that. I try to be mindful because I've had professors just drill that into me before, but not everybody does. So I'm also really thrilled to talk about your new book, Hello World, Being Human in the Age of Algorithms. And I must say, I think you're only the third mathematician I've had on my show, regrettably.
What an honor then, in which case I feel very special.
Absolutely, because I think I am in well into the 200s at this point on episode count. So many scientists, and we always, of course, tout how important STEM is, and then we just completely ignore mathematics, which is horrible. So we've spoken on the show before to Steve Strogatz, who I'm sure you know.
I do very well. He's one of my great heroes.
Oh, good. And I think he blurbed your book, which is great. Oh my gosh, so did Adam Rutherford, who I just recently had on the show.
He's my co-host for a podcast we do in the UK together.
Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh. Worlds are colliding. This makes me so happy. And then I also had on the show once quite a while ago, Arthur Benjamin, who does math and magic.
He's also there.
Yeah. I'm so excited to be like diving a bit deeper, hopefully, into the fascinating and exciting world of math. And your whole book is about algorithms, but of course, it's called Hello World. And Hello World has special importance in the world of computer science, doesn't it?
It certainly does. So anyone who's ever really learned to program is going to know this phrase, because it's kind of become a bit of a tradition, really, a rite of passage almost, that the very first thing that you do as a total rookie programmer is you teach your computer how to say hello world, how to get that phrase to kind of flash up on the screen. And rather than the fact that this phrase just conjures up, you know, quite nostalgic images of, I don't know, sitting in your loft as a kid playing with your very early computers, your first computer that you might have had, I think for me, the reason why I wanted to call the book this phrase of Hello World is because of the origins of the phrase itself. So it first came about in about the 1970s in a book by Brian Kernighan, a book on C programming, where he used it in the introduction as the kind of first tutorial. And he was asked a little while later as to why he'd chosen that phrase. And he said that he'd seen this cartoon where a chick was kind of hatching out of an egg and chirping hello to the world as it was being born. But what he never made clear was who the computer and who the programmer are in that scenario, which one's the chick supposed to be. And it's not totally clear whether it's, you know, the sort of programmer kind of climbing through and saying hello to the world of programming, or whether it's the machine itself that's sort of being woken up by the programmer. And I just really like that idea that it's sort of this moment of conversation between human and machine, where that line between who's the controller and who's being controlled is really blurred. And I just thought that was captured exactly the sentiment of what I wanted this book to be about, a kind of a moment of partnership in the age of machines.
I love that, because the way you put it, it sounds so cooperative, but then of course taken to its extreme. And I think we've seen this through Hollywood film, especially I'm thinking of 2001: A Space Oddity, taken to its extreme with maybe AI or even computer learning, neural nets, things like that. It can become quite a frightening sentiment.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And I don't think this is just something that exists in science fiction. I think that there are all kinds of examples, actually, where algorithms and AI and computers are given this kind of level of authority over humans to make decisions about how we're living our lives, about the things that we can do within our lives that actually are quite concerning, where we are handing over power and control to machines. And I don't even think we're always completely aware of just how much power we're ceding.
Oh, goodness. And of course, I mean, I'd love to take a step back now to talk a little bit about the programmer of this very book and the programmer of the work that you do. You know, I'm looking at some of your publications, and early on, you were doing some fluid dynamics work. Is that what you studied for your PhD?
That was my PhD. Yeah, exactly that.
And so is that in physics or in math?
So it's maths. I mean, I think once you get really deep into this stuff, the lines between what's math, what's physics, what's engineering become really blurred, because ultimately you're starting at the same point. You're starting with the same equations. I think the only real difference is the bit that you find interesting. So the engineer wants to just, you know, make sure they want to understand the equations to make something work. You know, the physicist might care a little bit more about what's physically going on in that scenario, but the mathematician just really cares about sort of the beauty and the elegance that's contained within those equations. So that was essentially what my PhD was about.
It's so interesting because when we talk about mathematics, I think that so much of our understanding of the field is conjured by the basic courses that we took when we were quite young. And I worry, and I'm not sure what it's like in the UK, but at least here in the US, that most people's appreciation of mathematics and most people's experience and exposure to mathematics is either not actually mathematics, but computation, or beyond that, some sort of kind of vague and ineffable understanding of maybe algebra or maybe geometry or maybe calculus. But really, the theory is heavily missing and the application is heavily missing.
Yeah, I think you're totally right. And I think that actually that's often a real shock for people when they go to university and say, you know, oh, I didn't like math, so I'm deciding to be a biologist. And then they get there and realize, well, crikey, if you want to be a biologist in sort of the current world, you really, really, really need to know a lot of math that's involved in it. And I think it's a real shame, actually, that you do end up with this vision of what math is when you finish school. I think it's everyone just seizes this kind of crusty old dusty subject that only lives in these textbooks that, you know, the answers are all in the back, it's all finished, you know, there's only one correct answer, all of this different kind of stuff. Whereas I think for me, I just don't see it that way at all. I see it as this living, breathing playground, really, just the ultimate playground where you can explore and be creative and just, yeah, endless possibilities, not just in the theoretical world, but, you know, that loop back around to understanding our own world much more too.
Absolutely. And what you said about requiring a lot of math understanding in order to be a successful scientist really rings true. But you don't have to be good at rapid calculations in your head. And I think that that's what a lot of people worry about, right? I was the quintessential young girl who was afraid of math and never felt like, you know, I had a lot of support from my teachers, you know, math isn't so much for girls, maybe, or let's call on the boys more in class. And so I was like, of course, afraid. I went into psychology and then eventually neurobiology. And I'm actually published on a physics paper that I don't even understand, like the math, and it doesn't even make sense to me because, of course, I did all of the wet lab work. But yeah. The deeper I got into psychology, the more I fell in love with statistics and realized that this is a whole world of mathematics that I didn't even know existed before I went to university.
It's just, I think for me, it's just this, it's like putting on a pair of glasses and seeing the world in a completely different way. I think it's, for me, it's almost as though we've got this parallel universes. There's one that we're living in, the tangible one, that you can kind of wander around and ignore anything mathematical if you want to. But hiding just underneath the surface, there is this incredibly beautiful, rich mathematical world, which just gives rise to all of physics, really, all of the physics equations and all of the sort of statistical findings that you can uncover when you start exploring. And I think it's just this really rich and wonderful environment that's just hiding just beneath the surface.
Absolutely. And, you know, when you study this academically, it can take many forms. There's pure theoreticians, there are people who do very heavily applied work. And I think it's so interesting looking at your CV, basically at your list of publications, how focused your research is or your mathematical work is on systems. And they really are heavily applied. Like you're writing about retail centers, you're writing about offenders, you're writing about infectious disease, all of these things that have like tangible implications for how the world works.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So this is, you know, after I finished my PhD, this is what I did my postdoc in, was looking at data around humans and trying to understand patterns in human behavior. And it sounds like the areas that I'm studying are really wildly far apart. As you said, you know, contagious diseases to riots to shopping centers. But in reality, there are these very similar mathematical patterns that are just hiding beneath the surface. And one of the obvious ones that unites those different examples is this idea of contagion. So this idea that once a shop becomes popular, that's something that spreads through the population, that the more people visit somewhere, the more people will want to visit somewhere. And you find that in something like rioting too, right? So if a riot kind of takes hold and starts to grow, it has this contagious element to it. And then hence, you know, looking at infectious diseases, that contagion element there as well. There are these, it's like you pull at a little thread of one of them, and then it just unveils this whole tapestry of connections between all these areas that feel like they're really far apart, but mathematically are actually quite similar.
Oh, fascinating. I've always wondered that about, you know, even let's say celebrity, for example, or like a very popular film, a singer who really takes off, that there's some sort of like tipping point, that they work very, very hard and they put in a lot of effort to promote or to do the work that they need to do to be quite present. But after a certain point, it sort of almost seems like self-expanding, you know, like the popular things just get more popular.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. I mean, you're describing something that's I think was done best in this experiment by Matt Salganik. I think that's how you say his name. It's this idea of social proof. So what they did is an amazing experiment. They set up a kind of experimental Spotify, right? You know, in this environment, and they asked people, they seeded it with loads of different songs that had never been published. So, you know, people wouldn't have heard of them, by a number of different artists. And they got people to go on, listen to the songs and, you know, like certain songs, right? Mm-hmm. And then other people would come on, see what previous people had liked, and then could choose which songs to download. The thing that they didn't tell any of the participants was that they actually had multiple parallel worlds, which had been seeded slightly differently. The same songs, but just randomness in the beginning was allowed certain songs to rise to the top. And they really demonstrated that actually there are some songs that are at the top that aren't necessarily of any higher quality than any other songs. It's just there is this kind of element of luck involved. And then this idea of social proof that people like what's popular, and that ends up feeding back onto itself.
Oh man. Yeah. I mean, it's the whole payola problem of like the 1980s, right? When people back in the day, like you relied on the radio, and if you got played a lot on the radio, you were set. Now it's a little bit more difficult for artists, of course, because there's so many more places that we can access content. And I'm sure that that's actually changed the algorithm, as it were.
Yeah, I think you're right. Although at the same time, there aren't gatekeepers in the same way that there used to be before. I mean, mm-hmm. in the past, you would have to persuade one or two music execs to buy into your idea. And then that was your route to sort of stardom, if you like. Whereas now, I think that you don't have to sit around and wait for someone to approve you. You can just build up an audience on your own. So I think in some ways, it's both easier and harder. But as a consumer, I mean, we are really spoiled for choice in some ways. You know, the amount of music that we have access to. And that's really why all of these recommendation algorithms are out there, to just try and filter out the just enormity of choice that's available to us.
Oh, and then of course, what do we do? I guess it really does depend on your personality, because my boyfriend, for example, is an obsessive music fanatic and looks at new music Fridays, I think it is, on Spotify, and has a record collection of hundreds or thousands, I don't even know, and listens to super obscure stuff. I listen to the same like 20 bands I listened to in high school and college, like most people my age, I think. And it's so funny that having too many choices can be just as crippling and overwhelming for many of us.
I think you're totally right.
And so, you know, it's so interesting that we go back to this conversation about algorithms over and over and over, because they really are ubiquitous at this point in our lives. Algorithms are used even in places we don't realize they're being used, aren't they?
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I mean, I think that this is just one of the ways, as a mathematician, that why I really wanted to write this book, as well as, you know, it being my research area, is that I just think that there are just this incredible way that essentially algorithms are just fancy dressed up maths, really. I mean, once you dig down deep enough, we're just talking about gigantic matrices, just talking about gigantic math equations. And they really are now changing the rules of how we're living. really. They're changing the rules of how we're interacting with each other. They're dictating what we read, what we watch, you know, in some cases, even who we end up dating. But they're also in as you say, these really unexpected places. You know, we're letting them drive our cars. We're putting them in our courtrooms. You know, they're in our schools, they're in our hospitals. There really is almost no area of modern life which is untouched really by these algorithms that now exist.
And of course, I'm reminded of a documentary I saw several years ago by, I think his name was Cullen Hoback. He made a documentary called Terms and Conditions May Apply. Mm-hmm. And it really dove deep into the balance, or I should say the opposing forces of convenience and privacy, that almost, you know, every time we give up a little bit more information, we are confronted with algorithms that can make our lives easier, right? We don't have to pre-fill anything anymore, or maybe we have these recommendations in front of us, and we really do rely on these shortcuts that our machines give us to make our lives easier. I don't remember most of my passwords. I'm just very glad that they're all pre-filled. But at the same time, that means that my machines know all of my passwords, and that's a major privacy problem when it comes down to it.
It's true. Although at the same time, I think that you can, there is no incentive for a company like, you know, Google through their Chrome browser to divulge that information to anyone. It's in their interests to have you think of them as a safe and secure place to mm-hmm. store your passwords. I think you're right about how we are making this trade. You know, we're swapping the convenience of not filling in a form online with giving someone else our password. But we're also swapping it in much more subtle ways, where the incentive of the company to keep that information to themselves and not use it against us isn't really there. So, I mean, the really kind of classic example of this is the supermarket loyalty cards that you get. So this is something that's been going on for a really long time, where companies have known that if they have information to what you're buying, they can infer all kinds of things about you. And I was having a chat with a company who sell home insurance in the UK. And they have access to this kind of data that people had swapped in exchange for vouchers, right? It was a fair trade at the time. You give up your data, you get vouchers in return. And this company had worked out, by looking at what people were buying, that people who were home cooks were actually far less likely to claim on their home insurance. And I guess if you really think about it, it sort of does make sense. You know, the kind of people who are going to spend an entire day preparing a meal probably are going to also be quite house proud. You know, there's a big overlap between those two groups. But the question is, how do you work out who is a home cook? And it turns out that there is one item that you'll find in a home cook's basket that's more significant than any other, giving someone away as a very house proud, responsible person. And that item actually is fresh fennel.
Wow.
He didn't actually make it clear whether if you start buying fresh fennel, that means that your home insurance will go down, unfortunately. But this example, I mean, it's quite frivolous in some ways, you know. We can kind of all chuckle at it. But there are other things like, you know, the data that is inferred from your Fitbit, perhaps changing your chances of getting life insurance, or as one company is starting to do, in fact, you know, or things that are found in your DNA if you have signed up to one of these DNA testing kits, you know, then being used to, well, again, sort of prevent you from getting certain access to different types of insurance later down the line. And I think that actually, when we are making that trade, deciding what's worth it, what right now, you know, giving up your data, what's in your shopping basket in exchange for some vouchers, we're not always aware of the longer term implications of precisely what we're giving up and just how much power we're ceding in the process.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, here in the United States, we are a heavy, heavy credit happy country. Like, you cannot do anything unless you have a high credit score. And that number is gold. You know, it's, you have to take out mortgages here in the US. I remember I was watching a television show. Oh goodness. It's a British show that was on Netflix about maybe Grand Designs. Is that what it's called? Love it. It's so brilliant. And they're, you know, they talk often, how are you going to pay for this? And they're like, oh, I have to take out a mortgage. Oh God, I'm going to take out 20,000 pounds. And I'm like, are you out of your mind? Like everybody in the US takes out a mortgage. That's how you buy a house.
Like, I think that's a remortgage. Believe me, everyone in the UK has mortgages too.
Okay, good. I was like, wow. And you know, it's like we all live our lives on credit. We buy cars on credit. We don't even consider school debt, house debt, or car debt. We call that good credit. Like, that's good debt. You know what I mean? Those are just things we're paying off little by little. Bad debt is when you go shopping or you owe money on your credit card. I mean, this is just how people live their lives. And so, I don't know, it brings me to this kind of depressing place sometimes when I think about it, where A, your credit score really defines you and it defines your capability to have potentially dire consequence, like you were saying, healthcare outcomes or financial outcomes as you age. But even beyond that, there's something that I always come back to, which is this, I don't know, glib view of the future, this kind of dystopian view. And it's happening right now where really everything comes down to marketing. Everything comes down to, like, when you look at the root source of the big money that's being passed around, it's how well can I buy a consumer? And it makes me very sad. I don't know why it makes me so sad, but that's elections in our country. That's all of entertainment, even educational entertainment. I mean, luckily we do have a little bit of sort of self-funded. This show, for example, is funded via Patreon, but I also read ads. It's the way that I can make my money. And, you know, you look at our big data online and really it's about, like you said, supermarket chains, yoga apparel companies, like these different really specific groups buying your data so that they can target, or they can have targeted marketing, isn't it?
Yeah, completely. And I think, you know, there is this dystopian angle to all of this. I mean, you know, if you look at what's happening in China, sort of this idea of a credit score taken to just extremes that are, I think, really dystopian.
It's Black Mirror. They're doing a Black Mirror episode in China.
It's this thing called Sesame Credit, which is a citizen score, essentially. So it takes into account things like your credit rating, but also things like what you're buying, your groceries, and even potentially things like linking up to the facial recognition systems around town and working out if you jaywalk, right? And giving you a lower citizen score if you're caught jaywalking. But these scores, they really matter. So things like what credit cards you can get depend on your credit score. If you have a certain score, you can use a VIP lane in Beijing Airport. You can hire cars without leaving a deposit. But there's also talk of limiting people's visas if their score isn't above a certain number. And at the moment, this system is voluntary. It's almost seen as a bit of a game. But the idea is to make this system mandatory in 2020. It's a government-run scheme for every person in the entire country who will have a score associated with them and everything that they do.
Of course, this comes on the back of, I was actually just in China a few months ago, and what I noticed was, you know, everybody there uses this program called WeChat, which is sort of like their Facebook, but it's also kind of like their Venmo or their PayPal. So it has all their information. I played in like a home poker game, and it was really funny because I was the only person who had to get cash because I'm not on WeChat, right? I was the American in the room, and there were a few Americans, but they were expats. So they lived in China, and everybody was just sending each other money via WeChat, and they were rating each other and giving each other scores. And it's like when all of the citizens, I mean, kind of like Facebook, when everybody's on the same social networking platform and then they fold in payment onto that platform, then they can fold in ratings onto that platform. It just allows for ease of these algorithms to really build on one another.
I agree with you. I mean, I do also think, though, it's very easy to sort of think of the really horrible dystopian
thing. I know.
I mean, I think it's worth saying that I am actually generally quite positive and quite optimistic about this new age of how algorithms are so much, infiltrating every aspect of our lives. I think there are these really big problems, you know, like the one that we're talking about now, about privacy and about control and about power. But I think there are also these gigantic upsides that also exist, interwoven with the negatives.
And you think that those are mostly about convenience? Do you think that they're about improving kind of health outcomes? Like when all of our medical data is in one place and every doctor can access it, they can immediately see our allergies. They can see how many, you know, what the meds we take are, what procedures we've had. I mean, we've never lived a life like that previously. We relied on the patient and sort of broken records to piece together a forensic picture of their health.
Exactly that. And there are occasions when, you know, that old style system has really let people down. There's one really tragic story of a young girl called Tamara Mills in the UK, who died of a fatal asthma attack when she was 13 years old, despite the fact that she had been to the doctor, I think it was something like 42 times in the couple of years leading up to her fatal attack, complaining about the fact that her medication wasn't working and just, you know, reporting increasingly more serious asthma attacks as time went on. But because that data wasn't held in a central place, because no doctor that she saw had access to the full record of information, there was no way that anybody could diagnose the bigger problem, you know, and in the end, it had a really kind of tragic outcome for her. And I think that, you know, across the board, that's just individuals. But actually, there are, you know, the idea of a DNA database where you have hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people's DNA to dive into. I mean, that is a fantastic resource in terms of the amount that we can uncover about our health, about our bodies, about, you know, treatments, about genetic causes, all of these things. There's an amazing, amazing potential there that can really revolutionize healthcare.
You're so right. It's so funny listening to kind of, and I shouldn't say both sides of the argument, because the argument is incredibly nuanced. And I think that obviously your perspective is nuanced, as is your co-host, as you mentioned, Adam Rutherford's. But it's interesting that when we were speaking on the show about these genetic tests, we were talking about the good and the bad that comes from them. Same with you. But I actively, you know, I'm a 23andMe fanatic all the way. I not only did I do the test, I actively log in and look at all of the updates, and I participate in research on 23andMe. And maybe that's just my kind of social science background. But, you know, I know that I struggle with depression. I know that I take medication every day. That's and I know that they have access to my genome. So I want to answer questions about my depression so that they can learn more about the potential genetic basis. Maybe that will help other people. You know, that's a really important thing for me, but for other people, that scares the shit out of them.
Yeah. I'm quite scared, you know, I'm not totally scared about it, but I will not get a genetic test, I think. I have not had one and I'm avoiding it.
Funny. Not only have I had one, but my dog has had one. And we sent in
samples.
Yeah, we sent in our samples on the same day. And by we, I mean I sent in both of our samples. And I just kept hoping that I put the right spit in the right tube.
On which one?
Yeah.
Wow, you've got you've got like really active saliva glands in your
I know. But yeah, I mean it's one of those things for me that I think for some people too, and I wonder what your take is on this. You know, I'll be 35 actually in just a few weeks as of this recording. And so I'm sort of at the tail end of the millennial sort of what would you call it, Gen X, cut off, maybe Gen Y, I don't know. And so I didn't grow up, I'm not a digital native. When I was quite young, I didn't have a computer, not until maybe late high school, early college. My dad had sort of a Commodore CQ, that's true, that we played on, and he made us do these like Doogie Howser style diary entries. That may have been a very American reference, I'm not sure. but I, you know, I didn't grow up learning computer science, and I definitely didn't grow up swiping on an iPad. But I do think I'm of an era where I kind of have given into the fact that, like, you can't maintain total privacy without going to such great lengths that you're lacking basic capabilities. You know, I've got to be able to do a Google search. I've got to be able to log into my email, and I've got to be able to purchase something online with a credit card. I can't imagine my life not doing that. But I know some older people who just refuse to even engage in these kinds of social contracts because of the fear of giving away too much of their personal information.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm probably, we're roughly the same age. And I think I'm with you on this one. I think the genie is out of the bottle, really. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, the privacy as we used to know it is really over. It's just a question of how far we allow what's already out there to be used to make decisions on us. Because, you know, this is stuff that really applies beyond advertising. I think, you know, this is stuff that can affect our future job opportunities. It can affect, you know, the if we ever find ourselves in a courtroom, you know, the data that's collected on us can, in theory, be used to, you know, make predictions about what we're going to go on to do in future. I mean, there's all kinds of different things, you know, within police stations, you can use people's activity on social media to target your resources. There are lots of different ways that go beyond just seeing adverts for slippers online every time you log on.
it's so true. And, you know, I think a lot of times we have a tendency because, you know, especially again here in the US, but I do think in the Western world in general, we're sort of at a very interesting place politically where as much as we are more advanced, I mean, if you were to ask Steven Pinker, he would, you know, put down his foot and say, we are in a better place than we have ever been. And I disagree with any arguments to the contrary. And although I agree with that, from a purely maybe statistical standpoint, the truth is that we are in a political place where intellectualism, academics, knowledge, critical thinking is sort of in crisis to some extent. There's a growing movement of individuals who look at that as though it's an elitist, partisan move, you know, that it's not a fundamental goal of all of humankind. And that really does sort of worry me, because I think what comes along with that is that we look at technology as if it's a black box and we have no interest in understanding how these things work. And if we don't know how they work, I think we tend to deify them. And when we deify them, we forget that algorithms at their core, and of course, I'm not talking about neural nets, we'll get there, but at their core are programmed by people, and people have biases. And this is a big problem, isn't it?
It is. It absolutely is.
All right, guys, I want to take a quick moment to thank some new sponsors this week, starting with Crickstart. What is Crickstart? It's what it sounds like. Yummy organic snacks made with cricket powder. Oh my gosh, they're so good. They are all plant-based except for the cricket powder, which is made from organically farmed free-range crickets. I know it sounds weird, you guys, but you've heard me talk about bugs as food before. It is so incredibly sustainable, and it's really where the world is going. They taste incredible too. Trust me. Cricket powder does not taste like cricket. There's no antennas. There's no legs in there. It's all mixed up into a fine powder. And then it's mixed with other delicious ingredients like seed butters, hemp, chocolate, and dates. There are incredible protein bars. They're delicious. They're so much better than other meal replacement bars. Like flavors such as chili chocolate and cinnamon cardamom. Have I talked about how much I love cardamom before on the show? It's like my favorite flavor profile. Guys, they are delicious. They are not chalky like you usually, you know, have to deal with in protein bars. I actually crave them all the time. And also there's these yummy crackers in flavors like olive and chili. And they're really good on their own, but they're also good with salsa, with hummus, with well, other people say guacamole. I don't like guacamole, but that's okay. You can have them with guacamole. I won't judge you. They're balanced in their macronutrient profile, so they're really good for a pre or post workout snack. And they're good for you. Like, they've got lots of polyunsaturated fats, omega-3s and 6s. They help you feel full. They're not high in, you know, sugar or carbohydrates. So all in all, Crickstart, guys. I can't wait for you to try it. There are over 40 crickets in every Crickstart bar and over 100 in every cracker bag. Can you believe that? For the same amount of protein compared to beef, cricket require 12 times less feed, 2,000 times less water, thousands of times less land, and they emit 100 times less greenhouse gases. That's why you should try them. Visit crickstart.com and you will get 20% off your order with the promo code NERDY. Again, that's crickstart.com for 20% off with the promo code NERDY. I also want to thank Pimsleur for their support of Talk Nerdy. Pimsleur is a method for learning a new language. It's conversational, and it was developed by Dr. Pimsleur. That's spelled P-I-M-S-L-E-U-R. He was an applied linguist and professor at UCLA and Ohio State. Now, this is not like other language apps because it's not a game app. You're not going to learn to speak a new language by matching words and images or playing different vocabulary games. You're actually going to learn by conversing, by training your ears to understand native speakers, which, as we all know, is so incredibly important for when you're traveling to places where these languages are spoken. Now, with Pimsleur, you don't have to find time after a long day of work to go to the computer and basically go to school again. You can actually do it on the go. You can actually reach an intermediate level in just 30 days, but you can continue on to more advanced levels even after that. And the Pimsleur method works. It's used by the FBI, by Homeland Security, by the State Department, by the Marines, by Fortune 500 companies, and of course, diplomats, journalists, business executives, a lot of different people out there have relied on the Pimsleur method. It is, you know, a scientific method. It was revolutionized, as I said, at UCLA and Ohio State, and it will improve your language learning, both at a conversational level and beyond. But don't just take my word for it. You can try the full course absolutely free for 7 days. It's 100% risk-free. You have nothing to lose by trying, but you've got everything to gain. Like a new language, guys, a new perspective, a better understanding of other cultures. And you, the listeners of Talk Nerdy, can try it right now. Just go to pimspeaks.com/nerdy. That's pimspeaks.com/nerdy. All right, guys, let's get back to the show.
I think it's sort of, it's twofold though, really. I think that we have this really strange and complicated relationship with this stuff, because I think on the one hand, we are very willing to blindly trust machines. You know, if a computer tells us something, we very often will happily accept the cognitive shortcut that it's offering us. Uh-huh. Don't think any further and just, you know, go with whatever it tells us. It's, you know, we're very good at accepting the easy authority that algorithms offer us sometimes. But then on the same, at the same time, if this stuff is ever shown to be faulty, if it ever shows any signs of weakness, if there are chinks in its armor, then we're very good at just dismissing it completely out of hand and just not accepting anything it says forevermore, right? Just, you know, just getting rid of it altogether. And in reality, I think that we need to do something in the middle, because you're right about how a lot of these systems end up having biases that can be quite concerning. And, you know, the courtroom is a really good example of this, of how the algorithms that are used in courtrooms don't necessarily treat every individual in the same way, because it's being fed on data of historical cases where people were not treated in the same way. You know, the history of our courtrooms is not exactly immune from bias. But I think that's an important point that you have to remember, which is that when you're deciding what to do in the future, you don't have the choice between a flawed algorithm and a perfect alternative where everything is absolutely wonderful and there's no bias and everything is totally fair. You're choosing between a flawed algorithm and flawed humans. You're choosing between the bias of one gigantic system or lots of little biases, you know, between a gigantic system of humans. And that makes it a very nuanced argument. As you say, you have to be much more realistic and stop either over trusting the machine or dismissing it out of hand altogether if you just see any kind of tiny flaws.
Absolutely. It's somewhere in the middle. It's much more nuanced. I mean, as my multivariate statistics professor used to say, SPSS, which is a software program that we use for the social sciences to run our statistical analyses, he would always call it a faithful idiot. You know, garbage in, garbage out. It will interpret or it will calculate whatever you tell it to calculate, but you as the human being have to decide if your data is good.
Yeah.
If your data are good, damn it.
I think you can say both. I strongly believe you can say both. I love that. Faithful idiot. I'm using that.
Absolutely. It's so reliable, right? Like, we use these terms a lot in social science research, validity and reliability. It is incredibly reliable. It will give you the appropriate, or I should say, a faithful response every time. But whether or not that should be interpreted is a very human choice. And so I think that that's sort of the question, right, is that as we start talking about more and more sophisticated algorithms, we move on from a place where it's fundamentally faithful to how the human beings programmed it, up to these complicated questions about computer learning and neural nets, where the computers themselves or the programs themselves have become somewhat recursive and are learning based on big data. And they're making decisions that even the initial programmers can't justify or can't understand.
Yeah, that's true. So this is a shift really in the algorithms that are being used in sort of everyday situations. So neural nets actually have been around for a really long time, but there's been an explosion in them recently, just because we now have access to really good detailed data on lots of, you know, lots and lots of things. And we also have access to really phenomenal computer processing power, which we just didn't have even 10 years ago. But the idea behind this different type of algorithm is that I think I really like the analogy of trying to train a dog how to sit. Mm-hmm. So when you do that, when you try to train a dog, you don't write it a list of instructions. You don't say, okay, move this muscle and then bend this part of your leg and then move that muscle and then sit down. Instead, all you do is you very clearly communicate to the dog the objective. You very clearly communicate what you want it to do, and then you reward it when it does that. And you just repeat that process over and over and over and over again until the dog understands what it wants you to do. And you leave it to work out all the steps in between. You let it work it out for itself, how it's gonna sit. So that's really what's happening now with machine learning algorithms, is that you communicate your objective to the computer, and then the steps in between, you let the computer tune itself to work out how to do it by itself. And there are some situations when that means that you are giving up explainability, right? You're giving up knowing what's actually going on inside that black box. There's no way that you can reverse engineer exactly that process and see what led it to make those decisions. But that's not always the case, I should say. There are lots of work that's been done recently actually about trying to kind of build algorithms so that you can understand what's going on underneath the hood. But I think that there are also some situations where actually the thing that you care about most of all is that your algorithm is right. You care about accuracy over explainability. And I think a really great example of that is in cancer diagnosis. I know that if it was me having a suspicious biopsy being analyzed, the thing I would care the absolute most about is the accuracy of that diagnosis. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't care necessarily about the explanation of it. I would want to know as accurately as possible what's in that slide.
Absolutely. I mean, it is such a, I don't know, it's such a complicated conversation, I think, for a lot of people who are like I always was, and I think it sticks around. I think it's quite difficult to shake that, but who have a sort of, I don't want to call it fundamental, but maybe a visceral fear reaction, or perhaps shut down. Maybe that's a better way to put it. And you of course, being a professor, have taught people before and seen the sort of inability in their face when they say, like, I don't understand this. I'm never going to understand it. I have to kind of take it on faith. And that's, yeah, I think, that's my biggest concern when it comes to a world that's become much more complicated than most people have expertise to be able to not just participate in, but to even have sort of an opinion about. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. But I think you make a really important point there, actually, which is that I don't think that algorithms have really changed that picture very much. I mean, I think all of science really is a lot like that. No matter how deep you go into something, there always comes a point where you can't know everything. You have to accept that somebody else understands what's going on and has okayed it, has kind of verified it. Mm-hmm. And I think I'd also add to that there are some situations in medicine where we know that something works without necessarily knowing why it works. You know, anesthetics, the one that people really go on about. I'm not a medic, so I can't confirm or deny whether that's absolutely true. But, you know, there are some situations where we don't have a complete understanding of what intervention, of how the intervention we're using works.
Oh, yeah, most of psychiatry is like that. Like, we don't really understand why my antidepressants work on me, but if you were to take them, they might have a really adverse reaction with you.
But you care that they do work.
Mm-hmm. That's all that matters. Yeah. It's true. It's absolutely true. I mean, that's really, that is the relationship, kind of the modern relationship that we have with science, technology, and really at their core level, algorithms. You know, it's interesting. We've been talking for quite a while about algorithms, but we never really, and by we, I mean I never stopped to ask you to maybe give just a basic definition of what an algorithm is.
Yeah, so I think this, it's a word that it doesn't really convey much information. And that's, I think, because it doesn't really mean very much. So it's like this really big, broad umbrella term. Essentially, all it means is it's a list of instructions. So it's something that takes you from some kind of input via some series of logical steps to some kind of output. So in theory, a cake recipe is an algorithm. So your input is the ingredients, your output is the cake, the logical steps are kind of the process of the recipe itself.
But in practice, when we watch the Great British Bake Off, we see that, especially the technical challenge, that algorithm could have direly different outputs. Huh?
You've got to be exhaustive in the way that you list. But yeah, I mean, generally speaking, the way that people use the term is to mean the instructions that you give a computer. So there are these really kind of obvious examples of algorithms that we use every day, like, you know, Google search engine, that's an algorithm. It's using the data of everything on the web and, you know, the objective of finding your particular query, finding items most relevant to your query. Amazon's recommendation algorithm that finds products that it thinks you might like to buy, or, you know, Facebook's newsfeed as well. That's another example of a very common algorithm.
Mm-hmm. And of course, kind of the first thing that I think of when you mentioned those three examples, a Google search, an Amazon recommendation, and a Facebook newsfeed, is how readily those kind of algorithms can be quote unquote hacked. You know, how readily somebody can say, I will study SEO, you know, search engine optimization. And of course, every large news organization, or maybe I should say entertainment organization, has an entire team dedicated just to SEO. How can we make sure that our site is the site that comes up first when you use certain search terms? Or on Facebook, of course, how can we ensure that our opinion is the opinion that comes across as fact when people are trying to read about what's going on in their political world?
I think what you're really hitting on there is just how incredibly powerful these very simple ideas have become. Because ultimately, when you've got just a piece of computer code that just ranks something, I mean, that's essentially what these are doing, right? They're pieces of computer code that rank stuff. It sounds so trivial. And yet it's something that ends up controlling not just the attention spans of hundreds of thousands of people, the jobs that people are getting, but also how powerful your product is in the marketplace, how profitable your company is, how well attended your event is. You know, all of these things are ultimately decisions that are being made by a piece of software. Yeah, it just demonstrates just how much power we've given over to them.
Absolutely. And I mean, this may date this episode, but just this past weekend, I was watching John Oliver on HBO and his desk piece, kind of the long in-depth piece that he does each week on his show. This week, it was about the Rohingya crisis in Myanmar. And he was talking about this group of people, obviously, who many people would say have been victims of a cleansing, you know, a genocide. And how Facebook has had an active role in this, because at a certain point, you can't just, as the sort of maybe holders of the algorithm, we could put it, you can't just set it up and watch it go and take a step back. But there are tweaks that have to be made because there are real political ramifications. You know, there are individuals who are reading divisive literature. And when that divisive literature climbs to the top and has implications like are happening in Myanmar right now, it becomes much more than just an idea. This has a practical outcome that's horrific.
I totally agree with you. I mean, these are really, really powerful equations, really. And that's what they are, you know, the hiding behind the scenes. These are just very simple equations, but they're incredibly powerful. There was an experiment that was done by Facebook a few years ago. I think that they've really learned their lesson in the past couple of years of just how important this stuff is. But there was an experiment where they manipulated people's news feeds to make them slightly more positive or slightly more negative, to show them, to prioritize news stories which were either positive or negative, just to see how people would react. And they found this, you know, this significant effect that people who were shown negative posts ended up posting more negative stuff, and people who were shown positive posts ended up posting more positive stuff. And, you know, in theory, I think that you could say, oh, well, it doesn't really matter, you know, you're just, it's a big data set, you've got access to this, you may as well run a gigantic experiment. But the thing is that you have to think about the people on the edge, right? You have to think about maybe there was someone who, within that group, who perhaps was just feeling, you know, was having a really tough time and was maybe feeling quite depressed already. You know, if you've got people who are kind of close to the tipping point, manipulating their emotions just even by a tiny amount can have catastrophic effects. It's just this very, you know, the whole community was massively up in arms at this experiment. And they've never done anything again since, and quite rightly so. But I think that, yeah, this is a lesson that Facebook has really learned in the last few years. You can't just move fast and break things when you're talking about stuff that involves this many people and, you know, and algorithms that are really that powerful.
Absolutely. And of course, we haven't even taken the time to talk about the kind of targeted marketing that we see on Facebook and the constant blowback and the constant changes to their procedures, or I should say their like community standards, when people are marketing only to men, or people are marketing only to white people, or only to a certain type of, you know, like at a certain point, like the intrinsic entrenched biases, stereotypes, I mean, stigmatization, and really just like inherent sexism and racism comes through these algorithms, because they're really just extensions of the people that are using them.
Yeah, and Facebook aren't alone on this. You know, there's been examples on Google Ads which have been showing higher paid jobs to men rather than women, showing adverts that relate to, let me see if I can remember this one correctly. There was a black female Harvard professor who Googled her own name and found adverts for lawyers, I think, for sort of, it was all to do with, it was expecting people with names that sounded similar to hers to be in trouble with the police that kind of thing. I mean, there are lots of examples of this, and you find it in sort of physical objects as well, in technology, where the algorithms are kind of embedded within the technology. There's an example by a chap called Chukwuemeka Afigbo, I think I've said his name correctly, where he came across a soap dispenser that worked, an automatic soap dispenser that worked perfectly well for his white friend, but failed to recognize his darker skin. You find this across the board, really. People just... And that stuff, maybe, you know, okay, I think you can argue that it's not that life changing anyway. But when you start having algorithms that are diagnosing skin cancer that don't work as well for dark skin, then I think you really start to get into serious problems about discrimination.
And to be clear, the reason that the soap dispenser didn't recognize him was not because the machine was racist. It was because, again, the machine is a faithful idiot. And when you don't have diversity in your ranks doing the programming, doing the coding, and doing the beta testing, then all of a sudden you're starting to see that only one perspective is programmed in, right? So the soap dispenser didn't recognize his darker skin because it had never been tested on somebody with darker skin. That's a problem.
Exactly that. It's quite rare, actually, that you find these examples of very serious bias that are as a result of intentional design. Mm-hmm. It's very rare that you find people who have anything other than very good intentions when they're creating their algorithm, creating their technology. More often than not, it's thoughtless omission like that. It's people just failing to test their products on a wide variety of different kinds of people and different kinds of environments that ends up, you know, with these gaping holes, these gaping big problems in the things that are being created. And then the other way that bias really creeps in is because our history is biased. Mm-hmm. And if you data that's based on our history, then you can be perpetuating the inequalities of the past.
Absolutely. I mean, I think a lot of people look at data as if it is just truth incarnate instead of understanding the hermeneutic, you know, sort of approach to data, which is, or to any sort of story, which is that we have to contextualize it in its time, you know, and history was written by white men. Like this, we know, like we know this. And when we look at a lot of these sort of large computer companies or even these small startups, still to this day, there is massive inequity in the individuals who are actually doing the programming. Like overwhelmingly, it's white men who are designing these protocols. So even if they aren't in and of themselves racist, just the fact that there's a pure omission of people of other colors and a pure omission of people of various genders, that's, I mean, it's problematic.
It's really problematic. I totally agree. I mean, I think that this stuff is changing. I think that people are aware of the problems that have been created and aware of the potential pitfalls that lie ahead. And I think that this stuff is changing. I think people are accepting that you do need to have diversity in the design mm-hmm. process. Otherwise, you won't have, you know, a product that works for everybody in the end. But it's slow. And the technology changes faster than people can. And I think that sometimes we're behind a little bit.
Absolutely. You know, this raises a question for me about quality control. So we've talked a lot about bias. And of course, a big part of any sort of computational system is making sure that it's reliable, but also that it's valid. It's making sure that it, you know, is faithful and it does what it's tasked to do and it does it well. But when we're talking about big data, I sometimes wonder how important it is that the data itself be good data. You know, and what I mean by that is, okay, here's a good example, a personal example. So in the United States, we all have a social security number, right? This is a number that we're given either when we're born or when we get a green card, or, you know, when we emigrate, become citizens, whatever. I'm not sure exactly at what stage the social security number is granted, but it's sort of a national ID number and it's linked to your name. And that's pretty much it. You've got a name and a social security number. Everything else may be linked based on the big system that you are involved in. But for the most part, those are two central pieces of data. So my name, my last name is Santa Maria. It's very Italian. It's also very confusing to the Department of Motor Vehicles, you know, the government institution that grants driver's licenses and license plates. It's also very confusing in my healthcare records.
Why so? Is that because there are two,
yes,
two words?
Because it's two words. Two words blows people's minds and breaks computers, apparently. And so, because it's not hyphenated, because it's not my mother's Santa and my father's Maria, it's just Santa Maria. It's a two-word last name. And I have a middle name. It's Louise, but I don't often use it. And I have a first name. But for some reason, when you look at my credit and my social security, I have like 25 pseudonyms, none of which are actual pseudonyms. I never put any of these forth, but my name is Maria C. Santa and Kara S. Maria and Louise C. Santa M. And it's just, it's so infuriating because I have no recourse. I don't know how to fix any of this stuff. And for the most part, like you said earlier, it's a bit of an annoyance, maybe, but it could have real ramifications. Like, what if I'm confused for somebody else? Or what if somebody steals one of my 30 identities, none of which I actually set forth when I was born?
And this stuff happens, you know, this stuff happens. There are certainly lots of cases of people with mistaken identity where trying to, you know, overturn the initial mistake has proved to be really, really difficult. And I think it's because I think in part it's because of this authority that we give to these algorithms. You know, once you dress something up as a computer decision, it makes it really, really hard to appeal. And I think just going back to that point that you made earlier about how unbiased the data needs to be mm-hmm. and how, you know, lacking in errors the data needs to be. I almost think that we need to just accept that having perfect data is going to be impossible. Mm-hmm. I've never come across any situation in the world outside of data and algorithms, which is perfectly fair and perfectly, you know, never makes any kind of mistakes at all. I just don't think those kind of systems exist. So I think that actually maybe a more sensible approach is to accept that there are going to be problems and that there are going to be flaws and errors. And rather than stressing about perfection all the time, start designing our systems to be easier to appeal. So start designing them so that they are built for redress when they inevitably make mistakes, rather than just thinking about getting that accuracy figure up all the time and being obsessed with that.
I so agree. And this is something that the American sort of mentality, or maybe I should say the American government, the long history, the very short comparatively history of American governance has never been very good at. You know, I often use the example of space junk when we talk about these kinds of things. Like, let's just throw the satellite up there. We won't actually think about what we're gonna do with it after it dies. And we'll leave that problem to future generations. And now, of course, we're like, holy shit, our entire near Earth orbit is like full of garbage and it's posing massive risks and we have no idea how to fix it. The plastic in our oceans, another perfect example. Like, we'll invent something later to clean that up. And I think we need to be talking about these sort of approaches to iterate, or these approaches to correct, or even these approaches to remove. They need to be built into the original plan.
Yeah, I agree with you.
So, Hannah, I've had so much fun chatting with you today. I hope that you'll indulge me for maybe 30 more seconds. I close every episode by asking each guest two final questions. And they're kind of big picture questions. And I'm super interested in your take on these as a mathematician and somebody who really thinks about the world in this way. Are you ready to go deep for a second?
Oh, yeah.
Yes. Okay. So when you think about the future, in whatever context is relevant to you, whether it's, you know, the global future, the future of your home, the future of your life, across the board, I'd love to know, on the one hand, what is the thing that really does keep you up at night, the thing you're very concerned about, maybe even a bit pessimistic about, that you spend a lot of time, maybe the problems that you want to find solutions for, and a little maybe less optimistic about their outcomes. But then on the flip side of that, let's talk about what you are genuinely optimistic about, not just lip service, but what is it that when you look to the future, you're very hopeful for?
So I think that the biggest problem that is facing humanity at the moment is climate change. Mm-hmm. And I think that this is something that we have seen coming for a really long time that we haven't managed to address. And I think that we're starting to see the sort of implications of it in terms of the way that our weather systems are changing, just the very, very beginnings of it. And I think that this is something without an easy solution, especially given that countries are so split, right? It's something that mathematicians call the tragedy of the commons. It's a very old and well-studied game theory problem that when you have a situation that can only be solved by everyone cooperating, it becomes very easy for people just to take care of their own interests. Mm. And as a result, everybody loses out. So I am really concerned about that. I think the only thing that's going to save us really is if some kind of invention is made that will make a big difference. So better batteries, for example, or there are enzymes that can break down plastic, you know, or yeah, I don't know. I think we need science to save us, really. That's really the only real hope. I think that if we continue on the path that we're on now, it's just going to be too slow.
Yeah.
But on the flip side, I think the things that I'm positive about are, I am actually, despite talking about them quite, in disastrous tones, I am also very positive about what algorithms and data can do for society. Because I do think that we have this opportunity now to think about our world a bit more logically, to think about it a little bit in a cleaner way, in a more rational way. And I do genuinely think that there are real positives to be had from that. I think that you can cut away a lot of the inefficiencies that we've had in the past. And I think that you can provide more fairness and less bias than we've had in our human systems, but only if you do it carefully and only if you make sure that you do it in a way that benefits everybody, not just a special few.
Oh, such an important note to end the show on. Hannah, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you. Her new book is Hello World, in the American version, the subtitle is Being Human in the Age of Algorithms. The UK version is How to Be Human in the Age of the Machine. And of course, you can find this anywhere books are sold. Hannah, how can people not just find you on social media, but also see more of your work? Because the one thing we didn't even have a chance to talk about, which hopefully we'll have you on again and we'll be able to dive deeper into, is the incredible work you do in science communication, the television work, the podcasting work that you do. How can people find all of this great content?
So you can follow me on Twitter. I'm Fry R Squared. It's a hilarious maths joke. All my podcasts with Adam Rutherford is The Curious Cases of Rutherford and Fry. And I have a lot of stuff on YouTube. If you look for me on YouTube, you'll be able to find some stuff there.
Excellent. Well, Hannah, again, thank you so much for joining me. It was an absolute blast.
Well, thank you for having me.
Absolutely. And everyone listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.